Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Here's the thing about death and taxes. You can't avoid them, but you can and should plan for them. That's the theme of our program today, as our financial planner stopped by to offer some prescient advice. And here's just one small bit of advice. The time for plan for 2015, that would be right now. Our financial planners today are Sandy Weaver. She's a CPA, a certified financial planner, and has worked in the industry since 1987. Sandy, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
David Jackson is a certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor for Waddell & Reed Financial Advisors. David, welcome back to you.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Barbara McMahon is also here. She's the president of InnoVest Financial Partners in Brookside. She's been in the financial services industry since 1992. Barbara, nice to have you, too. Good morning.
Thank you.
Well, let's talk about tax planning. Cindy, I'll start with you. Most folks just paid their taxes. This is that time of year when we're inundated with tax-saving tips and tax reduction techniques. Isn't it too late for all that?
Oh, no. This is a great time to start for 2015.
Yeah.
Because you have, you know, 8-9 months to work with here. So, you know, you want to think about getting income off that tax return. You want to think about getting expenses and losses onto the tax return.
So, David, what would you tell people who just got a big refund or a big tax bill this year? What advice would you give them?
Well, I would tell them not to concentrate on the wrong number. Because let me.
What's the wrong number?
Well, it's kind of difficult to do math on the radio. But let's just say we have a couple, two couples. One of them has, or both of them have income of $100,000.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has $25,000 of taxes withheld, and they get a $5,000 refund. The other couple only has $14,000 of taxes withheld, and they owe another $1,000 to pay $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
Which would you rather be? So a lot of clients will say, I'd rather get the $5,000 refund. I'm saying you're concentrating on the wrong number.
Meaning what?
You would rather pay $15,000 in taxes instead of $20,000.
Yes,
the refund
right.
is not the big issue. The $15,000 versus the $20,000 is the bigger issue. And so working with financial planners, are you doing your planning yourself in advance? Maybe you can drive that number from $20,000 down to $15,000. It takes some planning, but it's possible.
You know, Barbara, some experts recommend that it sort of makes sense to try to remain tax neutral, which I guess means what, and why is that the way to go?
Income tax neutral means that you neither get a refund nor do you owe.
You're right in your sweet spot,
exactly.
Zero. Yeah.
And I have to tell you, that's a tough spot to be in. And one of the things that's interesting is we as financial planners tend to think it's a failure if you get a large refund. Realistically, some people use that as a savings plan.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's nodding here. It's just a way for some people who just can't seem to pull it off any other way. At the end of the year, they get the refund. They know they have X number of dollars to spend on something.
Mm-hmm.
Is that good or bad planning? It really depends on the person. If that's the only alternative, I'm not against a refund. But I would caution, as David says, you don't want a big refund. It means that you're not tax neutral. It means that you have given the government the use of your money at 0% interest for a full year. And the reason now is such an excellent time to do planning is because you have last year sitting in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You have the numbers. It's a good time to sit down and look through all of it, figure out what worked and what didn't.
So ideally, you're saying, in a perfect world, you want to come out owing nothing and getting nothing back.
Exactly.
That's called tax neutral, Sandy. Yeah.
You really want to make sure you don't end up paying late payment penalties. You want to stay off the 2210.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so make sure you give them enough so that you don't pay extra because they said you were late.
Well, to what extent, Sandy, can workers control how much is taken out in taxes? Because for a lot of people, that's foreign territory.
Well, one of those is filling out the W-4.
Yeah.
And making sure that that's an adequate amount. You know, maybe, you know, if things have changed for you, you set up, you know, halfway through the year, take a look at how much is withheld.
Your host, by the way, messed that up this last year. Just for the record, I plead guilty. I'm suffering as a result. Yeah.
But usually it's a change in job or something. Normally payroll withholding handles it fine. You know, you might have 1 year where you adjust things. But beyond that, then, you can always send in extra money to the IRS. They are more than glad to do that, to take your money through an estimated tax payment. The other thing is to use the safe harbor rules, where you take your tax liability, the number that David was talking about, how much was your tax bill, and you pay in 100% of that. So as long as you get that done, the IRS is happy, and you'll stay away from penalties. If there are a couple of extra quirks in the safe harbor rules for higher income people, but I won't go into that.
Well, just be 101 here. Just where the say it's April and you paid too much this last year. How can you tell then if you're on the right track this year or not, in terms of how much tax liability you're going to have for next year?
Well, on your W-4, you can if your payroll is the same, you can always adjust your W-4. By an exemption, or you can have them, you know,
have more taken out. You're saying
yes, you can, and that can be a dollar amount too if you want that
mm-hmm.
way.
So you can control that situation through your personnel department. That kind
yes.
of thing.
Yeah, you can.
Your fate isn't set just based on your first paycheck in January.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about reducing income, David. You know, one strategy, reduce income, is a way to reduce how much taxable income you might have. There are different ways to do that. Ways like what? What would you point to?
Well, probably the most common for most folks out there is just contributing to their 401k. Making contributions into some type of retirement plan. Anything that goes into that goes in pre-tax, or it's an automatic deduction.
And that lowers your income then?
Absolutely. So, you know, right now I think the average person can do about $16,500 into a 401k, even more than that if they're over 50. And so, you know, based on knowing those numbers, you know, the more you put into the 401k, the less you're going to pay in taxes.
You know, when people come to see financial planners, at least my experience has been, you guys always sing the same note, which is you got to save more. You got to put more in your 401k. And so people don't come to see you as a result. They don't want to hear that.
Well, it's really good advice, though. And, you know, we were talking before we went on air about how many people in the 80s had good pension plans, and they didn't need to worry about saving for retirement.
Yeah.
And then their employers flipped the script and said, no, we're not doing the pension. We're doing a 401k. And so now we said basically the retirement planning has gone from the employer to the employee.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't manage it as the employee, what are you going to retire on?
Yeah. You know, give people a really round sense, David, as we're talking about retirement savings. You know, everyone's always saying people aren't saving enough for retirement. Let's say you aim at having $500,000 in retirement saved up over the years. If you turn that into an annuity, meaning you get a regular income off of that every year, how much will $500,000? It seems like a lot of money, but what does that translate to in very, very round numbers?
In really round numbers, you're talking about $20,000 to $25,000 a year. And then so if
which, of course, isn't a whole lot.
It's not a ton, but you couple that with whatever your Social Security is going to be, maybe that gets you up to about $50,000 a year. And you start thinking, okay, if I got $50,000 a year coming in, when I was working, I had $70,000 coming in. Maybe I can live comfortably on $50,000 because now I'm not saving for retirement anymore. Now I'm not putting money into other different types of plans. So, you know, it at least gives you a ballpark.
Barbara, we were talking before the show, there is this sense, and this topic comes up every time we bring up this idea of retirement savings. Many people aren't saving enough, and there's this huge wave of boomers about to retire, and many of them may be out of luck here.
I think you're right. I would also say it's never too late to start.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start. Now, one of the nice things about the 401k is, and I'm going to point out that David's number, that 16.5, is actually increased to 18,000. And if you are above the esteemed age of 50, you can put in an additional 6,000. So you can literally put 24,000 in. And the whole reason that was designed was to let baby boomers catch up. Now, I think all of us are seeing people who got hit 2008, 2009, those accounts dropped. In some cases, people made the mistake of getting out of the market instead of just gritting their teeth and letting it rise.
Right. Those were tough days.
Those were very tough days, and it was a very panicked environment. But they're still not totally out of luck. Typically, people, as they approach retirement, are looking at their best income-generating years. The kids may be out of school, so they don't have the college expenses that they might have when they're younger. and they can catch up. They can, or at least they can improve the situation.
Yeah, I remember getting those statements from Vanguard that handles my 401k and watching that number drop in end of 2008. That was just absolutely
It was not much fun. It really wasn't.
Well, we were talking, Sandy, about ways to reduce income, and David mentioned the 401k. What other things might people begin to look at to reduce their income?
A couple of things we always go through. One is take a look at your medical plan. If you have a high deductible health plan, then you really need to think about contributing into a health savings account.
Yeah, I do that. Yeah,
that's great because and one way to value these things, you know, these strategies we talk about, is take your tax rate times the amount of the deduction. So let's say that on your health savings account you're going to put in $3,000. You can actually put in $3,350, but let's say that you put in $3,000. Let's say that your marginal tax rate's 33%. So take that times, you know, the $3,000. That little strategy of using that is saving you $1,000.
Yeah.
So that's
right.
Worth it, you know.
Yeah.
If you're over the age of 55, you can, instead of $3,350, you can add an extra grand into that. Something else, if a lot of folks give, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 to their church every year. Well, let's say that your mother bequeaths you, you know, British Petroleum stock, and the cost basis is $5 a share.
Mm-hmm.
Give that instead of cash. And again, it's the same thing as if it's $2,000 and your, you know, marginal tax bracket's that. You know, it's far better to do that than to write a check.
Yeah.
And so just small ways of looking at different strategies to see if you want to spend your time or not. But if it's going to save you $300 or more, I think it's worth pursuing it.
Let's get our listeners involved here. We want to know what help do you need for filing your taxes next year, what questions you have about financial planning, taxes, all that stuff. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888. Option 2 is to tweet us at KCUR up to date. David, anything else you would point to lower taxable income? I'm thinking someone like myself is saving for college. So that's a big issue.
Yeah, and there are 529 plans are really good tools to use to be saving for college, and you can get a state income tax break. You don't necessarily get a federal tax break, but you do get a state one. And then if you have business income, let's just say you do something on the side where you're generating income not through your employer but on your own, there's certain tax deductions that you can take for being a business owner. So even if you're doing something similar to an Amway or, you know, or just selling some things on the side, you know, you're treating that income as business income.
Well, how about common itemized deductions that people can look at? David's just mentioning a couple. Barbara, what else would you point to here?
Oh, itemized deductions. The ones that we see in my office most commonly are retirement plans, which we've talked about, but while we're still on retirement plans, I don't want to overlook the IRA, which may or may not be deductible, but it's worth checking. I mean, it really is worth deducting. And the nice thing about anything like a retirement plan is it comes right off the income. You make a certain amount of money, it's deducted, it automatically lowers the income. But deductions, things that kind of go through the calculation process, mortgage interest, real estate tax, state tax, personal property tax, and then charities. Charitable contributions can also be a very nice tax deduction.
And folks, as you pay down your mortgage, your interest declines every year. I'm noticing that myself. Anything you can do about that? I guess buy another piece of property, right?
You can refinance the loan, because in any loan, the interest is always paid first.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you feel the need for that tax deduction, you could go out and refinance another 15-year, another 30-year. We've actually recommended that to some clients as they near retirement, just to get the payment down. But one of the beauties of it will be they will be paying significant amounts of each payment into interest, and they're going to have a very nice tax reduction because of that.
And you're extending the life of your loan, though.
You are. You are. And some people are unwilling to do that.
Yeah.
So it just depends on the person
and what they need.
Well, I was just going to say the timing is good for that, too, because interest rates are still kind of at an all-time low. So, you know, with people that are still paying 5% and 6% on their mortgage, it may make sense to refinance and you solve two problems.
Okay. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, let's move into estate planning. It's not just for the wealthy. Everyone should have a basic estate plan in place, our experts say we're going to outline key documents that everyone should have in their estate plans. We'll also discuss other areas of estate planning that individuals might consider to ensure their affairs are in order when the time comes. Why should everyone have an estate plan, Sandy? What's the point here?
So that you leave your assets to who you want to have them. Otherwise, the state will leave them to who they think should have them.
Yeah, and it's just that simple.
Yeah.
And how many people get their have their items in order, their business in order, compared to those who don't?
I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
A lot of people don't have all that stuff together, do they?
Yeah, and it can be done so simply, you know, and it need not be expensive.
Why is it simple?
If you have a pretty, let's say that, you know, you and your wife have two children, right? One in college, one not.
Yeah.
And so let's say that you don't have a thing in terms of a will or powers of attorney, things like that. But we already know you have a 401k. We know you have a 403b here. Those have a primary beneficiary line, and they have a contingent beneficiary.
We've done all that, yeah.
Yeah. So when you buy your house, we're fortunate here in Missouri and Kansas that they allow us to put a transfer on death on our house. And, again, that's a freebie. You know, it doesn't cost you $5.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when we have cars, we're, again, fortunate in these two states that we're allowed to put a TOD on the cars so we can transfer those to who we want to have them.
Mm-hmm.
Your life insurance has beneficiaries. So you're really looking at bank accounts can have payable on death. So you're really looking at not that many assets, perhaps, say, a joint brokerage account with investments. You can go back to your financial advisor institution and say, I want to put a beneficiary on that. So, you know, for less than $50, you can get beneficiaries on everything. Then you can need, you do need powers of attorney, and you can use blueprint forms, say, at NOLO.com or LegalZoom.com. Those can be bought for under $50, fill in the blanks for the state. And, you know, you can get the whole thing done pretty inexpensively as long as you have a pretty simple estate plan in mind.
David, are you surprised at how few people sort of have all this stuff pulled together, or are you beyond the point of being surprised anymore?
Well, it's interesting when you think about estate planning, the immediate thought goes to death, and who wants to think about dying?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was joking with the producer earlier about a lot of times people don't do wills because they feel like, oh, the minute I fill this will out, I'm going to die, you know? So, it's not...
People do say that.
Yeah,
you hear them
many times.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise that people are really slow to do it. But let me give you a real simple example of a couple of people that I've worked with and without estate plan. Well, actually, in both cases, there is some lack of. But a couple of fathers did a really good job of leaving their children, in both cases, about $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they died prematurely, left their, in one case, left their son $500,000. He turned 18. He has total access to this $500,000.
Wow.
It took him less than 6 months. He did not reach his 19th birthday before he had gone through it all.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah. So I'll give you another example where we had an incident that was almost identical, except there was a trust involved. And the assets went into the trust. And so, through no fault of the child, the money lasted until they turned 30.
Mm-hmm.
So from 18 to 30, they had assets. And then, you know, once the trust dissolved, then the assets kind of withered away.
Sort of meted it out slowly then,
right,
instead
exactly.
of having it available all at once.
Yeah. So when we talk about estate planning, the big thing we're talking about is if you die prematurely or whenever you die, what do you want to see happen with your money? And if you're just going to leave it to a child, maybe you should be thinking about, is that child capable of handling that money? Are there some other things I can do?
Man, going through that kind of money,
that's
kind of perfect. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or tweet us at KCUR. Up to date, we're talking about taxes, financial planning, all kinds of happy topics here today. Michael from Midtown. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for taking my call. Would your panel please talk about the relationship, or actually lack of relationship, between exemptions that you put on your W-4 and exemptions that you claim on your tax returns? A lot of people think, well, I'm married with two children, so I'll go marry two. Both, you know, both adults do that, and then they get hammered at tax time. It's a probably a poor choice of words.
Yeah. Who wants to grab that?
My hands are off here.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
I think the answer to that is so complicated, you need to sit down with a competent tax preparer, an enrolled agent, or a CPA, and go over it. As much as I would love to answer your question, Michael, I'm not entirely sure that we have the documentation and the reference material here to do a good job with that.
Yeah,
not
okay.
Enough information. Right.
Got a great question here from Joey, who tweeted this question. Graduating in less than a month. Congratulations, Joey. And landed a job in Kansas City. What is the first thing I should do for my financial planning, David Jackson?
Develop a plan. I mean, start thinking about, okay, what do you want to do now? I mean, is one of your goals to buy a house or to buy a new car or to, you know, really furnish your apartment? You know, think about what you're trying to accomplish with your money and make sure you understand the benefits that you have from your employer. You know, one of the biggest things, failures I see young people make when it comes to taking advantage of benefits is not getting into the disability plan.
Mm-hmm.
They feel, you know, indestructible, so like, why should I have disability, but, you know, through playing basketball or just being in a car accident, something can happen where your income stops. Where does the money come from? But really, I think just building a strategy of what am I trying to accomplish now that I have money.
Yeah, Sandy, how do you convince a young person to start making a strategy? People don't, when you're 22, 24, you're not thinking strategy.
But
you don't think strategy when you're 57, you know? Yeah.
One of the things you should sit down and take a look at the beginning is building an emergency fund versus paying off debts that you have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that the sooner you take finances seriously, the sooner you will have flexibility and options to do what you want in life. You know, so that kind of freedom, you know, we've seen some people walk in at 45 and, you know, they've got it to go. They can do whatever kind of job they want to do because they have saved and they've made all the right moves at the right times.
Mm-hmm.
And other people are, as you say, you know, working to 70 and in the saddle till they drop because they've always been behind the ball.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, usually if you just graduated, you might have student debts, you might have credit card debts. Take a look at interest rates. Take a look at which ones are deductible or not. And then balance that off against the other goal of, you know, the first rule of financial planning is to build that emergency fund.
You agree with that, Barbara? That makes sense?
I agree with that. And the other thing we usually encourage young people to do when they come into our office is start a retirement plan, because it's amazing. Small amounts invested when you are quite young have many, many years to build. And I've had the privilege of working with some people over several decades, and it's just an amazing amount of money. They started with very, very little, just what they could afford, increased it as they got deeper and deeper into the professions and could afford it. And now they're sitting on a very nice pool of money.
Hmm.
So as soon as, like Sandy mentioned, you kind of layer it. You start with an emergency fund, and then you build up to more and more complicated. But if there's any way to do in a retirement account, especially if you have a 401k and it has a match, the sooner you can get that full match, the better. That is an excellent goal to try to hit.
816-235-2888 is our number here. Charles from Topeka. Charles, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Nice to have you.
It's somewhat confusing to me, all the people who are involved in managing my money. I have a tax guy, I have a person who manages our trust, but we don't have a financial advisor. So I wonder, can you tell me, how do you find a qualified financial advisor? How much should it cost to have a good financial advisor? And what's the return on investment? Why will that pay for itself, I guess, would be the question.
That's a great question. Yeah.
I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Barbara, take a whack.
Charles, I concur. That is a great question. There are many different kinds of financial advisors, frankly, and we have several different kinds sitting here at the table, which is very refreshing to be able to work with other business models. Some people represent certain companies. Other people will be independent, and they will offer financial planning for a fee and products for a commission. Other people will be fee-based. You just walk in, you tell them what you need, and they line you up. One is not better than another, and the catch to finding a good financial advisor is you need to interview people. You need to set up appointments with two or three people that you think you would like to do, maybe on referral, go in, have a list of questions. I know the Financial Planning Association's website actually has a list of questions, and I've had people walk into my office with this and say, do you do this? How do you do it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good place to start. You need some chemistry. If you don't get along with the people that you're working with, the person that you're working with, it's the wrong person.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I've been interviewed by people that walked out of my door and never came back because we just didn't hit it off.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good. That individual deserves somebody who was a little more suited to their personality and to their needs.
Barbara, how could anybody not hit it off with you? I am. That just doesn't make any sense. Sandy, what would you add to that?
I would add, sit down with yourself and assess how much business knowledge you have, how much you're willing to learn, how much time and effort you want to put into it, and how involved you want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because then that will drive, you know, among these three different kinds of business models Barbara referred to, you know, some advisors do a little, some do a modest amount, some do it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, you know, it's like landscaping. Do I want to pay for the plan? Do I want to pay for everybody to do every last thing? You know, where do I fall in there? And so once you know what you want, what you need, what you're going to pay for, then go interview two or three advisors who work that way and always ask for client references and always check SEC backgrounds to make sure they've got a clean record.
Mm-hmm. Barbara?
I would also add, one of the problems Charles is having is he has several advisors. In my opinion, your advisor should be working as a team. And so we know the accountants, we know the attorneys, we talk with them. I will call accountants before tax season and say, heads up, capital gains are high or low or whatever, and let the accountant know what's going on. And that team approach can be a very positive one.
David, you want to weigh in here?
Well, I just wanted to say one of his questions was about the return on investment of hiring a financial advisor. And studies have really demonstrated consistently that those with a financial advisor do well or do better long-term with their investments, because when something happens like 2008, when the economy falls apart, they have somebody to call and talk to about, well, how does this affect me? Do I need mm-hmm. to make a change or should I stay put? Because when you have a dramatic event like that, the average person feels like, I need to do something. I don't know what I should do because I'm not trained in this, but I need to do something. And in a lot of cases, doing something is the exact wrong thing to do.
Yeah. We have one more call before our break here. David from Kingville. David, good morning. Where's Kingville, David?
Kingsville is about 30 miles east of Kansas City.
Ah, I'm sorry. Kingsville, yeah. Yeah, go ahead, David.
Okay, I have a question about the wisdom of the mortgage interest deduction, and I'm wondering to refer back to something that David mentioned earlier, if you're looking at the wrong number when you look at the mortgage interest deduction. It seems to me that if you're paying a lot of interest that you can deduct on your income taxes, that you're giving your money to the bank instead of giving it to the government, and I'm wondering what is the wisdom of that?
Hmm.
Well, that's a valid point. I mean, yeah, you don't want to pay interest just to be paying interest, but if you're rearranging things and you're making the same payment and you're able to deduct some of that payment, in some cases it makes sense, and especially if you're going to get a lower interest rate. And if you can take your interest rate from 3% down to from 6% down to 3%, which interest rates are at now, it is going to be a net in the long run of advantage for you. You're just kind of forcing some of those deductions up.
Sandy?
It
seems to me you can only deduct the interest that you pay somebody, right?
Right.
So you don't get to keep the money.
Right. And you're correct in that the more interest expense you pay, it's a bad thing, right? So
yeah, that's...
I understand that the approach you're taking from... but the point of being able to lower the interest rate on a loan, especially if you can stay with the same bank and they were willing to reamortize, then you've actually dropped the total interest expense over the life of the loan. Otherwise, if you go out and shop and you re-extend that term, that time period on the loan, then again, you're correct in that, you know, this may not be a good deal because I'm actually in the end paying more interest expense over the life of the loan.
Yeah, I understand. It seems to me that you're better off not paying interest at all and not being able to deduct it from your taxes.
The only time I think I disagree with you is if the interest expense is at a level where you lose the ability to itemize totally, then you've lost the other things that come in the basket, you see?
Barbara?
And I would also add that, David, you make a really good point. It's never a good idea to pay somebody interest, but sometimes that isn't the driving force. I know I've worked with families where we just needed to reduce cash flow, and refinancing a loan reduced the total mortgage payment, and it improved the cash flow enough to get the family through. So as Sandy alluded to earlier, you need to know your goals. You need to know what it is you want to accomplish, and that's what drives the decision.
Right. Okay.
David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You bet. Take care. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation with our financial planners. We'll talk more and focus in our second half about estate planning. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.
Coming up today on Here and Now, all eyes are on New Hampshire for those who have an eye on the presidency. Plus, we'll check in on the 119th Boston Marathon and find out why the California drought won't affect the cost of produce. That's good news. We'll have it all on Here and Now coming up at noon. Learn about our newest podcast, Statehouse Blend. Information is online at kcur.org. KCUR is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, supporting local reporting on KCUR and fostering economic independence through education and entrepreneurship. Details are online at kauffman.org. And the University of Missouri-Kansas City, celebrating 80 years of serving the Kansas City community and where thousands of alumni call home. They are UMKC proud. Information is online at umkc.edu/proud. We would like to thank everyone for their generosity during our spring membership drive. If you missed a chance to pledge your support, it's not too late. You can still call us at 816-235-5287 or pledge online at kcur.org. Again, thank you all for your support. It is 11:37 and 50 degrees in Midtown Kansas City. Sunny today, a high of 60, mostly clear tonight, a low of 42 degrees. Let's get back to Up to Date on KCUR.
And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed it, you can catch last week's conversation with members of NPR's political team. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with three outgoing Kansas City, Missouri council members on the state of our city. That's tomorrow on our show. This hour, we're visiting with some terrific financial planners, Sandy Weaver, David Jackson, Barbara McMahon, talking about all kinds of issues related to financial planning, taxes, and now we're going to talk about estate planning. You know, Barbara, why is it so important to have a plan? We're talking about, you know, estate planning here. What if you don't have a plan? A lot of people don't. Why should they be concerned about something like this?
Well, there are two main reasons that you want to have an estate plan. The first is to make sure that the people that you want to benefit, I almost said benefit from your death, that's a terrible choice of words,
but to inherit
your assets and the things that you belong, that you have, should go to. The second one is if you have no estate plan in place, the state has one for you. It has one written, and you will fall into their default estate plan. And that may not be particularly what you want.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, state of Kansas and the state of Missouri, they start off the same, and then they get very complicated. So let me keep it kind of simple. If you have a spouse but no descendants, your spouse will inherit everything. Now, keep in mind, I'm not talking about joint property. I'm not talking about anything transfer on death, payable on death that you've been able to name a beneficiary to. This is something that you and you alone own, because I can't imagine how many times people have walked in and said, if I inherit it, my spouse gets it, right? And the answer is, well, maybe, maybe not. What's the registration? All right, so if you have a spouse but no descendants, spouse gets it all. If you have no spouse, perhaps you're divorced, but you do have children, the children will inherit. The next level down starts getting kind of weird, because in the state of Missouri, if you have both a spouse and children, each will inherit half of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
In the state of Missouri, the spouse gets the first $20,000, and they then split the estate. The next half goes to the spouse. The other half goes to the children.
Hmm.
And I would say beyond that level, you probably need to consult with a competent attorney, because they start to vary quite a bit. And at that point, you need something more than you need a will, you need a trust, you need something.
Cindy, what's been your experience here while this stuff is important? You've come across some difficult stories in your time.
Yeah, we've had one of our clients, when we were going through estate planning with her, had put her adult daughter on the title of the car.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you don't want to do that. You know, sometimes you'll hear of older folks putting an adult child on a house title. You know, and the IRS has something to say about that. But what you want to watch out for is the increase in liability, and the if the daughter is, you know, driving the car and there's an accident, then it may be that you have put some of your other assets at risk.
Huh.
You know, and you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
We also have another son whose father, within the last year, has come down with increasing levels of Alzheimer's. And so we're able to use the power of attorney, and he's able to manage his father's affairs quite easily. But if that wasn't there, that document, you know, we'd be trying to work with someone who can't remember that he hired us, you know, and who we are. You know, and so that's, again, where, you know, a short document has saved the day. We also have...
What kind of document are you talking
about? Oh, that's a durable power of attorney for financial decisions.
Okay.
You know, there's two of them. You want one for finances, one for healthcare.
Mm-hmm. These are fairly simple, routine forms, right?
Yeah, right.
Most lawyers have them. You guys have them. Yeah.
Yeah, lawyers have them, or you can get, you know, blueprint fill-in-the-blanks off of NOLA.com, LegalZoom.com. They go by state. Each state has certain things they want to see.
Okay.
They're run by state statute. We have another client down in Texas, and the husband for the last 18 months or 2 years had ALS, and so it got increasingly difficult for us to work with him on his IRA and his other accounts because he couldn't sign his name and speak. And so, again, we had a power of attorney that, you know, we could deal with the wife, and she could tell us what needed to be done.
Yeah, David?
Well, it's just a simple example of why I think estate planning is so important. I was working with a client that had a fairly decent-sized estate a few years back. It died unexpectedly. I'd been trying to get him to get his affairs in order, and he just never got around to it. He did not have a spouse and did not have any children, which meant most of his stuff went through probate, and probate, you know, was determining, you know, to divide stuff amongst his siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two problems with that. Number one was that it took so long for it to go through probate. I think it took about a year and a half before the estate was settled. But then the other issue was the conflict that was left for the siblings to wade through everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just created such an intense battle within the family. I'm sure that's not what his wishes were.
Yeah.
And by simply going through the steps of planning his affairs, you know, the family doesn't go through that.
We're talking taxes. We're talking estate planning here this morning on Up to Date. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. You can also tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Dan from Olathe. Dan, you're on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I'm in my late 20s. I have a wife and I have a kid on the way. We also have tens of thousands of dollars of student loans, and I was wondering if there's any point in me having an estate plan when I still owe more than I have.
Wow. Yeah. Barbara?
Oh, that's a difficult one, and that's one I think I would probably like to see the numbers on. Dan, congratulations on the upcoming birth. I've dealt with people in your situation, and one of the things that we tried to do was see if we could get those student loans reduced. That's not exactly estate planning, but it used to be far easier. A decade ago, you could do it very easily. These days, it depends on whether it's a public loan, it's a private loan. I mean, it gets very complicated very quickly. I would still say you need to do some estate planning, though. Even if it's as simple as getting a life insurance policy, I mean, you need to take care of the people that you've left behind. You also need to consider who will be the guardian of your baby. That is going to be very important, just in case, God forbid, you and your wife are killed in the same auto accident.
Right.
So I would not discourage you just because you're just kind of starting out. Life insurance seems critical, a guardian. So you can do something about those student loans. I'd encourage you to do some research, but by and large, it's getting harder and harder.
Power of attorney, too, in case he becomes disabled. Yes, yeah.
That's a good point. I do have a life insurance policy, which would be worth more than the student loans I have. And I'm guessing if I were to go, I'm hoping I don't, the loans get the money first, and then after that, everything goes to my family, my wife, my child, and everything. So maybe that makes sense.
Well, Dan, let me interrupt just a second. My experience with student loans is unless someone has co-signed with you, your student loans die with you.
There's a cheery bit
of information, but you take those things to the grave with you, and that's something that your spouse shouldn't have to deal with unless it's not the type, it's an atypical type of loan.
It's bankruptcy where they don't get absolved. Yeah.
I see. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Dan, good luck. Good call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Linda from Kansas City. Linda, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier, somebody had mentioned something about that if you lived in Missouri and or Kansas, that if you owned property, like a house or a rental property, that you could do a transfer on death thing with it to go to transfer you through your children. And I was always under the impression that I had to do a beneficiary deed. So I wanted to be able to clear that up because it's something that I need to take care of. And I wanted to know if one was better than the other or what would be the best way to deal with that.
I don't know if a beneficiary deed is better than the transfer on death. The transfer on death, you go back to, you know, the county courthouse and it costs you $20. You can do it by mail in Kansas. I can't remember if you can do it by mail in Missouri. An attorney would probably be a better person to ask if one is better than the other.
Okay. But it's your understanding that I could just do a transfer on death and I could just put my kids' names on it and
yeah.
That would cover it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that'd be easier than a beneficiary deed, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great. And then my other question is, could you say those websites slowly that have the forms like the durable power of attorney and all that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Linda.
We have reviewed these documents that clients have brought in, and they seem satisfactory. And one is www.nolo.com, N-O-L-O.
N-O-L-O.com, okay.
Right. Quite prevalent in this area, legal documents for all different reasons. The other one is www.LegalZoom, LegalZoom.com.
Okay.
And I'd like to add to that answer, the thing that's important on these documents is the signing process. Make sure you have witnesses. Make sure you follow the instructions very carefully, because usually it's the signature part of these documents that can get you into some trouble.
Well, and you might make sure you get the right form that you buy it. You know, we had one brought in which was the wrong kind of power of attorney. So have someone review it for you.
Yeah.
Okay, and on that transfer on death, is there a form for that for legal property, or do you just... Because down at the county courthouse, they don't really want to give you a lot of information because they don't want to be legally bound.
Right, yeah. I think it's a one- or two-page form, and it has the legal description of the property, which you should be able to pick up off your mortgage papers.
Okay. All right. Thank you for
good questions, Linda. I'm glad you called. Thank you.
We're
talking about lots of different documents here. Maybe this would be a good time to sort of walk through the basic documents that people should be thinking about, and if they haven't gotten these done, maybe they should put these on their to-do list. Let's begin with a good old-fashioned will. David, talk to me about that. It's important. Why?
Well, let me step in with the will, because it's a mistake a lot of people will make, is that they may have, let's just say, their 401k or an IRA with a lot of assets in it, and they, way back when, selected a beneficiary to them. And then on their deathbed, they say, well, I need to complete a will. And so in their will, they said, somebody else is going to be the beneficiary of that IRA. The legal, whoever you listed as the beneficiary of the IRA or the 401k, that takes precedent over the will.
Huh.
So a lot of people make that mistake. They think a will takes care of everything, and no, it doesn't. Hmm. So in some cases, there's not a whole lot for a typical person that a will is going to do, because so many of their assets they can title as with a beneficiary or a transfer on death, and the will is to cover the other things.
So the will is overrated.
It kind of is, in a sense.
So why would you? I've been thinking forever. I've got a will, but it's been a number of years since I've updated it. I've got to update it. You're thinking what?
Well, it depends on how your estate is established. You know, and so if you have
my estate,
yeah.
You know who you're talking to here. I'm a public radio talk show,
yeah.
David.
That, we
that's
all
what
have
I am.
Stuff.
I'm proud here. I own a few basketballs, I guess. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, put the basketballs in the
okay,
will.
Yeah, there you go.
But
yeah.
Your retirement plan, that's superseded by whoever you designate it.
So should I do a will? I mean, I guess you're saying it depends on your circumstances, right, Barbara? You're nodding your head. Yeah.
Depending on the age of your children, you need to name guardians for minor children so that the will would do
that's,
that.
That's under 18.
That would be under 18.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, who do you want to handle? Who do you want to actually oversee the distribution of your estate? A will lets you name the executor, the representative. You'll hear those two names.
Okay.
So you need somebody trustworthy who can do that, or perhaps a bank or some other institution. But naming, especially if you have minor kids, you really do need that will. That's mm-hmm. the best way to care for them.
You're nodding your head, too.
Well, a will also handles assets that don't have titles, like basketballs and household goods and that antique desk. And then anything you forgot about. Let's say that you left a life insurance policy to an ex-spouse and the ex-spouse is dead. You know, then the will can help in those cases.
Okay. The next document here, the revocable or the living trust. Who wants to handle that? Sandy?
Oh, revocable trusts are great. They help.
What is that?
Oh, it's a trust where you can change your mind. You can put an account into this trust and a big investment account, or you can take that back out. You can put, you know, your house can be titled in your trust, or you can take it back out and own it individually. The nice thing about those trusts is that it avoids probate, which can be an expensive process
mm-hmm.
In some states, 5 to 10% expensive. So, you know, think of how much is on that list. The other nice thing about revocable trusts is, let's say that you have 3 children, and 2 of them handle money well and 1 does not. You know, you can say, you know, to the 2 children, they get theirs at 30, and to the 1, we're going to dole it out for 20 years, and then you'll get yours at 50. You know, you can do things like that. You can say, as long as you don't have a gambling problem, I'm going to distribute my assets to you when I die. If I do, you know, if someone assesses you do have a gambling problem, we're going to take another approach and have a bank trustee involved.
And if you want to do, Sandy, a revocable trust, does a lawyer need to handle that?
Yes, it gets more complicated.
Yeah.
There are blueprint forms, but I think I'd shy away.
Okay. Okay, then there's something called the irrevocable trust. Barbara, tell me about the irrevocable trust.
In an irrevocable trust, you cannot change your mind. So one of the examples that Sandy was giving, you put assets in, you put property into an irrevocable, you take it back out later. That's a good point. You can dance with it. An irrevocable trust, there are no partners on the floor to dance with. Once you put the money into an irrevocable trust, it stays.
Why would you do that?
Mostly for tax purposes, to tell you the truth.
What are those tax purposes?
In an irrevocable trust, the trust owns the assets. In a revocable, you still do because you still can't change your mind. So because you have control over the property in a revocable, it is yours, and an irrevocable is not. One of the interesting things is revocable trust will take your Social Security number, and irrevocable has its own tax ID number. So you can see very clearly through the tax code that these are quite different.
Okay. We have a few minutes left here, 816-235-2888, if you have questions for our experts here. David Jackson, the financial power of attorney.
Now, these come in really handy in cases of non-traditional couples or people that are just living together, or if you don't have a spouse, you know, and you get in a position where you are too sick or whatever to handle your financial affairs. Who are you authorizing to step in on your behalf to mm-hmm. handle your financial issues?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they'll come. That would be part of the will, you know, getting somebody designated who would handle your finances.
And is that a hard thing to set up, or how do you do this?
It's a pretty simple process, and I'd imagine there's one of the boilerplate plans that you can do there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that nolo.com? Would that get you there?
They have those.
Now, I'm going to express, you know, Sandy's really big in favor of those types of forms. I think with the average person out there, their limited ability to just do a basic tax return, trying to do their own estate planning without the benefit of an attorney, I would be really hesitant to advise people to do that.
Yeah.
Because it's just easy to make mistakes that are, you know, you can't unwind from.
If you go to an attorney and have them draw up your revocable trust, they're going to have all of those documents as a package.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do it better than the forms you could, you know, forms you could buy. But.
Okay. How about the health care directive, Barbara?
The health care directive.
Or a living will.
Thank you. It's more commonly called a living will. It lets you withhold treatment if your disease or impairment hits a certain point and you would prefer not to be resuscitated, just be allowed to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where you get an opportunity to tell people how much care you want near the end of your life.
Happy talk we're going to have here. This is a talk you're going to have, very, very happy. And then there's the health care power of attorney, Barbara. What's that one?
The health care power of attorney says, this is the person that speaks for me about my health care if I cannot do so.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband, for example, has the health care of attorney. If I am unconscious and if a health care decision needs to be made, he's the person I've designated to come in and make that decision.
Okay,
for me.
And David, we've talked about all these different kinds of papers. Where should people keep all this stuff? It's one thing to have them, but if you can't find them, then you're not doing anybody any good.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of people will keep them in a safety deposit box, but or just a safe in the home. But you need to let people know where these documents are so that they know how to get to them and how to address them.
Okay. Yeah.
And I would also say I've advised some non-traditional couples, gay couples, to keep a health care directive and a health care power of attorney with them when they're traveling, because many states still don't recognize marriage or relationships, and I've never had them use it, but I want them to be able to pull it out and say, no, I really can't make decisions for this individual. I have a legal document here that proves it.
You actually carry the document with you.
Yeah, and it's kind of a doubter. I know that, but until the laws of the United States are coherent and similar, I would just rather be cautious.
Why shouldn't everybody carry that information with them?
That's a good question.
I mean, why not, right?
Why not?
Yeah, okay. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Sharon from Kansas City. Sharon, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you. I have attempted to learn how to file papers. Are they required to be filed, or, as your current conversation is talking about, just to have them secured and have people know where those papers are? Is that what's required of a will and an estate plan?
Sandy?
Yes, just have people know where they are. It doesn't hurt to have a couple of copies, perhaps with your doctor's office. They'll keep them for you now, your medical, your health care. Ask and we'll keep them.
So in theory, you could have them in your house. You could give them to a neighbor,
yes.
A trusted neighbor, a family member who lives somewhere else.
Right.
They can actually have the stuff with them.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, Sharon, you bet. Thank you. Well, we've covered, like, a whole lot of ground here. Any final points, David, in the 20 seconds we have left?
Well, I think we all know that we're going to die at some point. So
don't speak for yourself. Well, the documents I signed over the weekend suggest I am never.
Well,
I'm not going there.
I think you should plan for the other anyway.
just think about it anyway, right?
Just in case.
Well, we had some great experts here. Sandy Weaver, a certified financial planner. She's worked in the industry since 87. David Jackson, he's with Waddell & Reed Financial Advisors. Barbara McMahon is president of InnoVest Financial Partners in Brookside. You guys were just terrific. Thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find all of our broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, Kansas City, where it's been, where it is, and where it's going. Outgoing city council members share their thoughts. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Lisa Rodriguez, Beth Lipoff, Eliza Spurtis, and Will Trumper. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.